Well, we're here to talk about Robert McNeil and Burden of Desire, a book which I have read, and I found this explosion horrific. Here's a taste of history that I guess, like most Americans, I wasn't even aware of.
Yeah.
So give me a little bit of background to this novel and the events leading up to the explosion.
The explosion was a story that I knew from growing up there. My mother was a child of 10 when it happened, so I heard a lot about it when I was a kid. In 1917, December, the third year of the First World War for Canada, the United States just into the war at that time, Halifax, Nova Scotia, was a big rendezvous point for cargo ships taking munitions and troops to Europe to pick up convoy escorts, warships, to protect them from the German submarines who were sinking them at a great rate. And Halifax is a very big harbor. And on that day, December 6th, a cargo ship that had been loaded in Brooklyn, New York, with high explosives destined for France, comes into the harbor, doesn't carry any red warning flag because it's supposed to be secret, and in a narrow part of the harbor, right by one of the most heavily populated areas of the city, it's in collision with another ship coming out. It burns. There's a deck cargo of benzol, aviation fuel, in drums, and some of those break, and so the deck is flooded with aviation fuel, and the sparks from the collision ignite that, and it burns spectacularly for about 20 minutes while the crew has nothing to do but abandon ship. They know it's a live bomb, this ship, but there's nothing they can do about it. So the rest of the city of Halifax gathers at its windows to watch this spectacular fire. 20 minutes later, it blows up, and it is the biggest man-made explosion before Hiroshima. Kills nearly 2,000 people, wounds 9,000, many of those wounded by glass in their eyes because they're watching at their windows. And it that's all out of a city of, and it destroys 2.5 square miles of a city of 55,000 people. It's the biggest impact of the First World War in terms of violence on this continent. And then 24 hours later, a blizzard dumps 30 inches of snow on this devastation where they're still trying to get bodies and living and survivors out. And that night, my grandfather, who was a dentist, was one of those who got a sleigh and a horse and went around collecting clothing and blankets to take to the homeless. And I use that in my story, too. And one of my characters does that. But Robert Oppenheimer studied the Halifax explosion in trying to calculate what the effects of an equivalent in nuclear power would be when they first dropped the bomb on Hiroshima. So it's a very important explosion. And it took Halifax a long time to recover. Many American cities and states sent immediate aid, Massachusetts particularly, because it was so close. It became the big banner headline story all over this country. And yet in the book The Chronicle of the 20th Century, published a few years ago, which I use as a reference book a lot because it's so handy, which has a page for every month of the 20th century, it isn't mentioned. Mm. Somehow it got skipped.
Well, the Americans have a rather cynical role as they set up an emergency hospital.
Yeah.
And are not too well, although I think the Canadians respected their efforts, I don't know that they respected the Americans per se.
Well, I think what I'm getting at there is that little bit of old-fashioned anti-Americanism that is an ingredient in many Canadians' sense of their own identity. It's a mixture of envy and condescension, I guess. And it was particularly acute in the kinds of people who were the power structure in Halifax at the time. But you'll notice in the novel that it's the silly characters who are most resentful of the American self-importance as they come in. And, you know, but people around the world have felt that when Americans came in to help, that there was a lot of officiousness and overbearing do-goodism about it. The point of that story is there was a train that went round all the way around through Maine and New Brunswick through that blizzard, got to Halifax with a 100-bed, fully equipped field hospital. And a lot was made of it politically. The Canadian Prime Minister came down and everything to meet them. But they immediately began treating 100 people. There were 9,000 people who needed treating. So it was important, But it was a an important gesture of friendliness and everything, but it wasn't the answer to everything. And you'll find that the people I regard as the sort of sensible characters in my book are quite appreciative of the American effort. It's the sort of silly people, some of the sort of upper crust there in Halifax, who resent it.
Now, you mentioned...
Or resent the American manner.
Well, yeah. Even Americans. I also hate to use the term American so forth, because Canadians are Americans, too.
I know, and one ingredient of Canadian nationalism, like a lot of South Americans, they sort of resent, when they think about it, which isn't very often, the U.S. appropriation of the term American, because we're all Americans, you know.
Now, you mentioned that your grandfather drove the sleigh, and you used many of his recollections. So that was your primary source, as I note in the afterword.
Well, it was the sort of colloquial source when I was a kid. I don't have many facts, although I stick a few facts based on their experiences in the book, mm-hmm. partly for humor and partly just for little family references. For instance, I did have an uncle, I had an uncle, my mother's younger brother, who actually was sitting on his little old-fashioned potty upstairs in their old house and was blown off the potty when the explosion happened. So I have that happening to a little boy here, and his sister makes fun of him for it.
Well, the description of the injuries is horrific.
Yeah.
Tell me where you got that.
Well, that's all. There are a lot of factual accounts of the explosion now, published in small books and papers here and there. And each of the injuries that I mention in my fictional account is documentable. It was actually observed. And so I've used the reactions of people I invented to try and express what people's personal feelings would be about this, but all the injuries happened.
Now, the explosion is the
back... The other, interrupting you, the other reason for that is to try and bring home, as it was brought home to the people of Halifax, the kind of violence that is happening in their name on the Western Front during all the horrendous battles of the First World War. Seeing the sort of way people's bodies are torn up by this explosion is, or becomes, I didn't intend it this way too deliberately, but it does become a metaphor for what their government is doing in France.
Yeah, and you do point out in the book that the Canadians had a tremendous sacrifice, much greater than of the Americans in that war, okay. And that if the Americans had that kind of casualty list, it would be an outrage in the country.
And in fact, it happened in the Vietnam War.
Yeah.
It became gradually an outrage. For all that the press and television are blamed for turning the American people against the Vietnam War, I think sober appraisers and historians believe it was the mounting casualty toll which finally got too much. That's arguable, that's debatable maybe, but America lost 55,000 people in the Vietnam War, and we know what it did to this society, that death toll. Canada, and that was out of a population of about 225 million back in the late 60s, early 70s, Canada lost 60,000 dead in the First World War out of a population of 7.5 million. To imagine that in the American context, you'd have to imagine this country, the United States, losing 1,650,000 people during the Vietnam War instead of 55,000 people. And by the time my story takes place, about 40,000 of those deaths have occurred, two-thirds of the final death toll. And it had an incredible impact on Canadian society. It is still, for Canadians, the mythic war. And when I was growing up, I was born in 1931, so the first sort of 8 years of my life were before the Second World War broke out for us, and the First World War was the war, and then my whole sort of sensibility was created by people who were writing about and thinking after the First World War, so it's very close to me.
It also comes up in the book that there is a question as to whether or not the Canadians should even have been fighting in that war. That wasn't really their war.
Well, that was certainly raised by French Canadians, because a lot of French Canadians, people in Quebec, refused to fight in what they regarded as England's war, not their war, even though it was French soil that was being defended from the Germans, because by that time, Quebecers, had long differentiated themselves, no longer had any particular loyalty to France. And the resistance to conscription in French Canada became a very big, tearing political issue then. But in English Canada, at first, the reaction was enthusiasm. They rejoiced to rush to the colors when Britain went to war in August 1914. Most of those who did immediately were immigrants from Britain. They'd been British-born. And then as the casualties mounted, the enthusiasm wore down. But the only active resistance to the war began to surface after conscription was introduced in the third year in 1917. And they actually, at rallies for the Prime Minister, they howled him down and threw stones at him and shouted at him. That was the third year of the war. But the news media were so carefully controlled, and the reality of what was happening on the Western Front was so muted in the censored accounts that were allowed to get out, that there was really no opposition to the war expressed, except by individuals.
Well, you make that very clear.
The press was incredibly, embarrassingly for us now as journalists, jingoistic.
Well, you make that very clear with the character Julia, whose letters from her late husband Charles complained bitterly about the butchery in Europe, and she tries to give these letters to the press and have them published. And it's apparent that, in a way, the press is playing ball with the government.
Because there's no First Amendment in Canada or Britain, and all governments try and control the press in wartime most of the time, and they got away with it then. I have he writes in those letters about General Haig, who was the British commander-in-chief, and I had him despising Haig for being a man who wantonly sent men into combat and was a bit of a fool in his strategy and tactics. I am now reading, it's just been published after my book, I'm now reading a new book called Haig's Command, which is a very serious historical investigation of Haig's incompetence, and it is far worse even than I knew about before. And as part of the memos that pass among the high command, it is these sorts of things mustn't be allowed to get into the press. The public must not know that X thousand people were wiped out in this battle. So there was a deliberate attempt to keep the public from knowing.
Now, Burden of Desire, in the novel, the explosion is really the backdrop for the relationship of two men, Stuart to a psychologist and Peter, the Anglican priest. They went to a private boys' school together. Mm-hmm. I guess they met long before that.
Yeah, they knew each other as small children.
That's
yeah.
right. Mm-hmm. So tell me a little bit about your two main characters and their relationship.
Well, it's funny because one of them was meant to be the sympathetic one, Peter the minister. I thought of him originally as being the sympathetic one, the one the reader would like all the way through, and Stuart the psychologist being the unsympathetic, the sort of leering one. And they knew each other as boys. Stuart's family was very well off. His father was a banker. Peter's family being Church of England minister himself, his father. They were sort of respectable but middle class, hard up middle class. And when they go off to school, Stuart is born as one of those boys who looks rather girly. She's kind of fat and runs badly, and he has heavy glasses, and he plays games badly. And Peter is the thin, lean, athletic type who's good at everything. And Peter is supposed to go off to boarding school, which a lot of Canadian boys of that class did, Stuart's father thinks it would make a man of his rather fat and ineffectual son to go off and be toughened up by this school. He's a laughingstock, and he's bullied, as happened, and he's subjected to homosexual harassment, which happens, or did happen in schools like that. But in the end, he's the more thinking one. He's the one who enjoys reading more, whereas Peter emerges with a very early sense of vocation as a minister, emerges as the much more rigid and disciplined one. And uptight, I think we would say today, whereas Stuart is more relaxed about himself. And gradually, as they grow into men, Stuart is in his behavior, the more open and easygoing and tolerant and understanding of his own nature and other human nature, and Peter is the more intolerant, reserved, self-disciplined character. But at the point when the story opens, he's married, very unhappily, his wife is what we would now call, I suppose, clinically depressed, only they don't know what to call it then. She's had two children, she's terrified of having a third one. His home life is a misery. But also, he can't get close to God. He's thought all along by disciplining himself, denying himself the sort of pleasures of the flesh and everything else, that he would get closer to God, and he can't. Whereas Stuart, whose nature has taken him in a different way, has been put in touch with the new thinking of Sigmund Freud, so shocking to people at the time, has begun to study Freudian techniques briefly, but is now a professor of psychology. He sees the world very differently. So that when the very personal diary of this young woman, Julia, expressing her loneliness and her erotic fantasies and so on for her husband, absent for 2 years, when as a result of the explosion it falls into Peter's hands, and then he later shows it to Stuart, it produces very different reactions in the two men.
Well, you have a complex plot with so much interrelationship of characters, Marjorie and Betty and Maggie and on and on and on. Yep. What's it like creating this cast of characters? It's like almost an extended family of your own, isn't it?
Well, it is. I believe, I've been trying to write fiction, I tried to write plays years ago, and I'm trying to write novels for years. And this is the first one that's really worked. But I believe, I guess I'm kind of old-fashioned in my taste in novels. I like novels where I know the characters well enough and know their families, because unless you know something about their childhoods and the kinds of people they grew up among and how their parents treated them, it's hard to understand them as individuals, I believe, as grown-up individuals. So as I went along, I didn't sit down. There are about 50 characters in this book, some of them very minor, but I didn't sit down at the beginning and say, I'm going to need 50 characters, and here's what they're all going to be. I started with three characters. Started with one, the woman, then Peter, the minister, then I needed another person for him to show the diary to, then, and they all needed parents, and Peter needed in-laws, his wife, and needed in-laws, and then they all needed other characters as they came along, and when I needed another character, he came along, or she came along. And I was trying very, very hard to paint what I thought would be a sort of believable picture of that particular society in that particular time, and I needed characters who would do that.
Well, the city of Halifax. So somehow I pictured that as an extremely romantic place, a seaport town, but you describe it as being a rather rough, hewn town.
Yeah.
Rather primitive with, as one of the characters points out, very few amenities, no galleries, no music, no opera.
Yeah, it's a European woman who points that out, a very avant-garde a woman doctor from Germany. And, of course, Germany at that time, many people thought, just before the First World War, was the rising power in the world. That's where a lot of the new science, the new developments in industry, it's where a lot of new architecture and other thought had happened. It was regarded where a lot of the experimentation in psychology was happening. It was regarded as a very progressive place. And she comes in with these new ideas to this rather fusty little provincial seaport. Provincial in its way, but cosmopolitan as all seaports are, but a very closed little society, which had very few amenities, public amenities. And like most small cities across North America, in this country too, they didn't boast much in the way of comparing them with small European cities. And so her observation is really used to make it sound rather, rather primitive, and it was in that sense. I mean, people who had position and power and some money had very gracious lives, But if they wanted to go to the theater or to concerts, they went down to New York, or they'd go to Europe, when it wasn't wartime, or they'd go up to Montreal or Toronto.
What was it like for you growing up in Halifax?
It was very provincial and limited, and it was a place I very much wanted to get out of as I grew up. In fact, I did. I thought, as people do in small towns, I thought, God, it's all got to be happening somewhere else.
Now, you have a map of Halifax in the book. Where did you live in conjunction?
I lived down in the South End on a place called South Park Street. It's there. It's down the street from where Julia lives, and it's around the corner from where the other characters live. I mean, I know those streets very, very well because I grew up sort of within a few blocks of where I imagine all those characters living.
Did you go to a private school as well?
I didn't in Halifax, but I did later. I went to that school for 1 year.
Brutal when you went there, as it is in the book?
Yeah, it was about that. Yep. In my case, I loved it. I thought it was a terrific place, but I knew boys who did not love it. And I observed things like some of the things that I depict in the book.
Do you think school authorities would tolerate that in today's age?
Well, they do if they don't if they find out about it. But in some very badly run schools, the all-boys schools, the masters may even have some complicity in it. I don't think that happens much anymore. There are occasional scandals where it does. But I think they realize now that single-sex education for teenage boys may not be the best way to organize things, and so most of those schools now have girls in them. I know that school does, and has had for a long time, and they've just and that has made them a good deal more civilized.
Yeah, I think that boys want to be on their best behavior in front of girls. They don't want to be embarrassed.
Yeah, but also boys who may be ambiguous about their emerging sexuality, and in any large group of people, there are always going to be some, probably find it easier to define themselves if there are girls around than if there aren't. I mean, it's like the population of men in prison. Sooner or later, there's going to be, I mean, sexuality has its way of expressing itself, and it will in whatever society.
Now, you mentioned adding characters as you needed them. Mm-hmm. Is this the way the book grew as well, or you took the germ of an idea and it just kind
It started when you and I talked about my book Wordstruck mm-hmm. some years ago, and that was about my growing up in Halifax.
Right.
And that opened some psychic doors for me, because it made me think very intensely about the years during the Second World War, when my mother was a young woman and her husband was off at the war for 5 years, and the husbands of her friends, who were also young women, were off. And I think, and the idea came to me in the middle of writing that, what would it have been like for, I remember going out and saying to my wife, you know, it'd be neat to write a story about a woman in the First World War in this town, when everything was even more constricted. What would it have been like for her then? And I think a child knows really nothing about his parents' sexuality. You get a kind of, in fact, you don't even believe they have it.
No, parents don't have sex.
Parents don't have sex.
No, I know from my own personal experience with my parents, they don't have sex.
Yeah, right. Well, I must have inferred something. I must have got a kind of coloring of it, because it came into my mind as a fully formed idea about a woman who longs for her absent husband. And then how does she express it? She can't tell anybody, because especially then, women weren't even allowed, few women were allowed to acknowledge to themselves that such feelings were decent.
So Julia was the key character.
Yeah, she's the one who came first. Mm-hmm. And then, so how would she express this? Well, I resorted to the old literary device of a diary. She expresses it in a diary, planning to burn it, and then as a result of the explosion, the diary falls into the worst hands, in a sense. I mean, it falls into the hands of this very uptight minister, who is at first shocked by what he reads, because he believes that decent women, he always thought decent women didn't think that way. And then he becomes tantalized by it, and we'd say turned on by it now, and then finally obsessed. And in trying to find out who she is, because she's used just initials for names, he shows it to his friend Stuart, And Strata knows immediately who it is, because through another series of coincidences, if you like, or brilliant plotting, Stuart has found her already.
Well, it's not unusual, Halifax being a small city.
Very small,
where everybody
and that,
knows each other.
That community is, that group of people in the South End was, you know, a few thousand people. So, and the geographical area is very small. So it was, I don't think it's improbable that.
I think some of your readers might be a little shocked at the amount of sex in Burden of Desire, but it's not that explicit. I mean, most of it is implied.
Yeah, and an awful lot of it's in the head, yeah. You know. I mean, it's thinking about it, and that relates, of course, to the title. I don't think, to me, it's not out of proportion to what I understand about life, and it, you know, there's a lot of sex in life, and a lot of thinking about sex. There's a lot of repressed sex, as in the case of Peter, which converts energy into other forms of behavior.
Have you been back to Halifax, Burden of Desire in hand?
Yeah, I went there for the launch of the book, as a matter of fact. And
what was that like?
Oh, it was wonderful.
What happened?
It was just, of course, not many people had read it yet, but I had the wonderful experience of being in a bookstore, signing books.
Now Halifax has a bookstore.
Oh, hell of it, lots of books.
So you didn't have one in 1970.
No. Yeah, it's full of, I think she was being unfair. It did have a few bookstores then, but she was just sweeping in her condemnation, this German woman. But anyway, I was signing books in a bookstore, and I looked up, and there was somebody who looked very familiar, and suddenly her name came back to me, and it was the first date I'd ever had, and I had been her first date when we were 13. I'd taken her to a school dance, and it was so amazing to look up, because I left.
Did you recognize her?
Oh, yeah. Sure I did. But I hadn't seen her since we were 13, and nor she me. And it was really extraordinary. It is an amazing experience in life to look up and see a 61-year-old woman, which she must be if she's my age, and see the 13-year-old girl in her, right there.
But you could see it.
I could see it, yeah. Absolutely. Yeah,
I went back several years ago. I went back to my 25th high school. A senior class.
Isn't that an amazing experience?
Yeah. And what they did, they photocopied your picture from the yearbook.
Oh, wow.
And you wore that as a badge with your name on it.
Yeah.
And amazingly, once I was there for a while, I recognized everybody.
Yeah.
And the weird thing entered my mind, that the 25 years that had passed was a longer period than we had known each other at the time of our graduation, because we were all 18 or 19.
Sure, yeah.
It's kind of eerie when you think about it in those terms.
Yeah, but also the kind of knowing that you have in school. I mean, you're together. In those days, we had 5-6 hours in the classroom, and you're thrown together for your whole society, and you have a kind of intensity of knowing that also children are so receptive to all the, because their minds are not full of other business as happens as we develop more responsibilities and get older and become more distracted. But children are open, I think, to all sorts of impressions of people they're with that get stored away, that are very rich, which is why I think it's one of the great sources of writing and other creativity. A child is all raw receptors, I think, and you have a kind of an intensity of observation at that age. I mean, I don't know about you, but I would be able to sit down and sketch a word portrait of many of my classmates from when I was 10, 11, 12 years old. And find it harder to do it for people I had worked with maybe 10 years later when I was in my early 20s, or 20 years later when I was in my early 30s. Is that
And I'm sure you'll find, as I did, that the kids who were class clowns when we were in high school together, those who were quiet and those who were smart, mm-hmm. were the same adults, as 45, 50-year-old adults. They were the same. Yeah. Their basic character and personality had not changed.
One of the books that intrigued me enormously some years ago, I don't know whether you remember it, called Is There a Life After High School? And that really fascinates me, because high school is a very intense experience. One is at the age when everything's happening to you. I mean, you're discovering your first real notice of the opposite sex. You're having your first emotional involvements, really strong emotional involvements. You're just growing into your adult body and mind and everything in all ways. And at the same time, you're having success or food for self-esteem, or the opposite, the lack of it, in an atmosphere which is felt intensely, in piercingly. And then you go out from that atmosphere into the wider world, and the people who did really well in high school often, you know, they've had such nourishment to their self-esteem that it seems to carry them through the rest of their life, and nothing is ever quite as good as that from there.
Early burnout, maybe.
Yeah, I know what it is. And other people who were the shyer, quieter, and apparently less successful people in the high school atmosphere often do very, very well later.
It just shows that everybody grows at his or her own pace.
Yeah, yeah.
Did you find that many of the people you went to school with remained in Halifax, or did they go out into the big world like yourself?
A lot went out. I would say about half did, half didn't. Part of what distorted it was, the time I'm talking about was the Second World War, and many of the parents were in the services and were there just because of the war. So later they moved away all over the place.
That was essentially your situation, too.
Yeah.
Your father is a Navy man.
Yeah, right.
Yeah.
Mm-hmm.
You had mentioned that you had wanted to write novels. You'd written a number of nonfiction books, and you had wanted and you tried, and nothing seemed to work out until Burden of Desire. Why do you have this impulse to want to write fiction?
I don't know. I think in one way that I am like my brothers, living out some of my father's fantasies. My father died at 53, quite young, and he wanted to be a writer. His model was Hemingway, and it just didn't work out for him. But he put enormous value on books. Books were the one things he had, even when he couldn't afford anything else. And he read all the time, and he conveyed to me, and then my mother read to us a lot, both of them conveyed to me the value of books. And the idea of being a writer was sort of held up as something impossibly attractive, something very valuable to be. And I think some of that colored. But I always wanted to be a storyteller. I mean, when I was a reporter and as a journalist, I've always enjoyed telling stories. And I had a brief flirtation with wanting to be an actor, which I fortunately got over at the age of 21.
No, you're still an actor.
Yeah, well.
But you, in the back of your book, there's a list of nonfiction books about this giant explosion.
Yeah, right.
You could easily have taken those books and done some personal research, first-hand research, and done another nonfiction book.
Yeah.
And what you would have created would be a chronology of this terrific event. But in a way, in using this as the background for this, you created wider truths. You could explore many things, including people or relationships, and not just the event itself.
I've known about the explosion, as I said, ever since I was a kid. And it wasn't the first idea that came to me. As I told you, the idea was this woman character and the two men that she becomes involved with. Then I needed a device for her to cause her to lose the diary. How does a woman lose a diary? And suddenly it clicked in, and I thought, oh, God, I'd forgotten about the explosion. Of course, I'll make it in December 6, 1917, and I'll use the explosion. And I really had, for some reason, pushed the explosion out of my mind. Although about 10 years earlier, a new book had come out about it, and I'd read that and been quite intrigued, and it must have been sitting there in the back of my mind. But so I wasn't writing a book about the explosion. The explosion is just a way to get it started. I could have written a nonfiction book about the explosion. But
it's been done.
It's been done, and it didn't interest me to do that.
But no, I think you obviously wanted to explore the psyche of your characters and their interrelationships and how people react to one another and what they do and what they feel,
and I
what they hope, what they dream.
Yeah, and I was really interested in this business because I've lived outside Canada now since I was 24 years old. I've lived in Britain or in the States all that time. And I wanted to, a couple of things were on my mind. One was, so many of the new ideas that have shaped the 20th century mind that we take for granted today had burst on the scene before the First World War. That first decade before the First World War, decade of the century, a lot of new ideas had come out in psychology, in music, in painting, in dance, and in writing, and in science, all of which shocked some people at some of the time. I mean, when Diaghilev and Stravinsky produced their new ballets for the Ballet Russe in Paris, there were riots. People tried to tear down the theater. When the paintings of Matisse were shown, critics raged and stormed. They called them the wild beasts because he used color in a different way. And one of the points I wanted to, two points I wanted to make. One was to explore how many of those new ideas would have crept into this little closed society by 1917. And how many would be resisted? And then also the idea that ideas, it's very funny, but ideas are more frightening to people, new ideas like that, they're more frightening in some ways than the idea of sending all your sons and husbands off to be killed by the thousands in the First World War, because it's the patriotic thing to do. And I thought that was very interesting. And in fact, my character Stuart, towards the end of the book, remarks on that. And if there's a theme, that's one of them. Here are men being slaughtered by the thousands, sent over in human waves, like the kind of way that troops used to go into battle during the American Revolution. You know, you lined them all up, they pointed their guns forward, and they marched forward. And, of course, anybody who could shoot at them knocked them down like toy soldiers. Only these were living human beings, and it was being done with far more sophisticated armaments, big artillery and high-impact artillery shells and machine guns. And yet that was tolerated because you had to fight the Germans, you know. In fact,
yeah, war is not a new idea.
In fact,
it's an old one.
What Germany and Britain were really fighting about, it's probable. It's not they were fighting about all sorts of things. In Germany, the Kaiser did invade Belgium and violate treaties and try and create greater room for Germany, so he was an aggressor. But many people had seen that war coming maybe for 10 years before, and there were people in Britain who thought, in fact, it's stated in the book, that Britain thought it might have to go to war with Germany because Germany was becoming too big an economic power and was challenging Britain all over the world in its markets and in its sources of raw material and in its merchant fleets. And there are those today who see parallels with that situation and now and predict, people have predicted, that the United States might eventually have to go to war with Japan out of economic rivalry. I mean, it seems horrendous.
It's been hinted, that's true.
Oh, actually, book, The Coming War with Japan.
Sure.
You
say whenever
I'm not suggesting that. I'm just saying that that it was considered absolutely normal and quite understandable and the right thing to do, because Canadians were still in a colonial position and loyal to King and Empire, to send their men rushing over to be killed in great waves by the thousands. And yet they were outraged that a man like Freud would publish books saying that human sexuality was one of the prime movers of human behavior. And that Matisse would paint with combinations of colors that had never been seen before, or that Stravinsky would write music that shocked people because it sounded dissonant and had a different scale and so on. It is fascinating to me how the fear of new ideas rubbing up against what seemed to us quite horrendous old ideas. After all, Freud's ideas didn't kill anybody, and Matisse didn't kill anybody to look at Matisse's paintings or listen to Stravinsky's music.
Well, I also have this theory that if you happen to be a moribund administration and you run out of ideas, you can always bomb Gaddafi. Declare a war on Iraq, you know, and that makes it look like you're thinking about something at least. Well, to wrap things up, Robert McNeil, you have a very full cup every day with your PBS broadcast. How do you find time to do all this extracurricular writing?
Well, I have a very predictable, sedentary schedule now. I don't have to be in the office till 10 in the morning, and I'm there 5 days a week. So I have a couple of hours in the mornings when I'm on something like this. I have my weekends, I have vacations, and that's when I write.
Your next novel going to be set in Nova Scotia?
It's obviously rich. This setting helped me find whatever pieces of myself are creative that I think I'd had trouble finding before, and I was writing too much with whether it's the right brain or the left brain, I forget which. And maybe I will go back there to use that juice.
Well, you have 61 years of life to draw on, and you've been all over the world, so you're not going to run out of ideas. Burden of Desire, it's a terrific book by Robert McNeil. Thank you very, very much.
Thank you, Don.